Welcome to the Sleepless Cinematic Podcast, where we explore our shared love for watching and discussing movies recorded in the late after work hours, often in lieu of a good night's rest. I'm Madeline.
I'm Emilio.
And I'm Julian. The three of us are colleagues at a Midtown Manhattan music school. Yes, music is what brings us together, but movies are what keep us together, talking at the end of the night. So we've created some order to this ongoing trend and now record these conversations, considering an overarching theme while we cycle through five unique guidelines for engagement.
In addition to these main episodes, we record and release bonus one-off episodes as we see fit, and plan to do more of that in the coming months. While we do this, you, the listener, can count on the three of us doing what we've grown to love, foregoing sleep for a discussion about movies every other week.
And this week, we continue our current cycle of movies related to high school with a category that we call Mise en Scene, where the three of us watch a film that none of us have seen before and discuss our impressions and main takeaways from a first viewing. And that movie today is Fame, the original Fame movie from 1980.
I'm gonna live forever.
Directed by Alan Parker, and not to be confused with the 2009 remake of the same name.
Ah, yeah, that's
not,
right.
And not to be confused as well with the David Bowie song Fame from 1975, which, according to Wikipedia, this movie was named after.
Ooh, wow. Also not to be confused with the off-Broadway musical Fame, which Julian and I both just learned about from our former guest host, Anthony, who told us it's very fun.
Oh, cool.
It's bad.
Good bad.
Okay.
Yeah, oh, gotcha. In his words.
One of those.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with the television show that this movie spawned.
Exactly.
That's true. Yeah.
And not to be confused with one that's a completely different title, which is The Game. David Fincher, 1997.
Oh, very different, very different.
Very different movie.
Yeah, totally. They both, I guess, take place in New York a little bit, though, or New York adjacent.
Yeah.
So,
got to tell one rhyme from another, though.
Yeah, that's very true. No, we're talking about Fame, the Alan Parker movie. On a slightly unrelated note here, I do feel like every time I say Alan Parker, I want to say Alan Parsons so badly.
Yeah.
And very different. No, this is Alan Parker.
Film director.
Exactly. Not, film director.
Not prog rock musician and producer.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So not to be confused.
Or Alan Partridge.
Ah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, that's the Steve Coogan character.
My
right?
God, we can... there are landmines everywhere talking about this movie.
You see, this is why we do this, you know, because we have to sort these things out.
It's confusing.
We all have a lot of names in our heads.
Yeah, we do. No, we're talking about Fame from 1980, Alan Parker. And yes, he's the director. And this movie follows a group of students at the High School of the Performing Arts in the heart of New York City. And I'm just going to go through a couple of these and just maybe give a little slight description of how we first come to see them. So we got Montgomery. He's a famous actress's son who also wants to get into acting. And we got Bruno, who's a classical musician who's embracing the modern age and is caught between worlds. There's Coco, who's a very talented singer and dancer who becomes Bruno's friend and partner in music. There's also Lisa, who's a chatty dancer. There's Doris, who wants to be an actress, but she's an introvert at heart. There's also Leroy, who's an illiterate, disadvantaged black youth who's got raw skills for days but has an attitude problem. And there's Ralph Garcia. What's that?
Sorry, and lots of knives.
And lots of
knives. So many knives. He's got tons of knives.
Oh, my God. Yeah, definitely.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's right. There's also Ralph Garcia, who is a smart, alecky comedian who wears his trauma and his emotions on his sleeve. There are a bunch of other ones, too, but it follows the journey of these and other students at this high school from freshman to senior year as they experience early life highs and lows of getting to throw themselves fully into their artistic passions. What did you guys know about this movie ahead of time, by the way?
I mean, in the past, last time we did a mise en scene, it was with Coda, and there was a very specific set of reasons why we hadn't seen that movie. But for this one, it's not so specific. I just think simply I hadn't gotten around to it
yet. Yeah, it was just a blind spot. Like, I feel like I knew the basic plot of this movie. It takes mm-hmm. place at a performing arts high school in New York. I mean, which is now LaGuardia.
Yeah.
That's my understanding, too.
Yeah. I'll go a little more into the history of that in a few moments, but
yeah,
continue.
We'll let you speak to that as the New York native. But yeah, I feel like that I had that general knowledge, and that was about it. Even the song, even the title song, I don't think I knew that it was from this movie, because they don't say the title Fame. They don't say Fame in the song. Mm-hmm. I don't think.
That's true.
So when that moment comes up, I was like, oh, that's where that song is from. It's like, I knew the song, but I had no idea of its origins.
This song also feels like so many other songs from the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So I get it confused all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was reading that when they filmed the scene that uses the song Fame, the song hadn't been written yet. So what they played on set was Donna Summer's Hot Stuff. And that feels, you know, of a very similar ilk.
Oh,
very
for sure.
Appropriate.
Yeah,
I do really love that idea, because I love that scene in general. That's like maybe my favorite scene in the movie where they're like dancing in the street.
Yeah.
I guess they could have played that song. I don't know if that was out yet. I don't think so. Dancing in the Street.
You're talking about the one...
The Mick Jagger, David Bowie one?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, because there's the previous version by, I think it's Martha and the Vandellas.
So that one would have been out.
That would have been out for a while. That's like the Motown version.
Yeah, the Mick Jagger, Bowie, I don't think would have been out yet.
There's also Dancing in the Streets by Van Halen.
Yes.
Which probably was about two
years away from being released.
Yeah.
Yeah. But still, I hear you. That would have been a good song.
Yeah. It's funny to consider these, like, Martha and the Vandellas might have felt weirdly retro for this movie.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. No, because it does feel so much of this time for whatever reason.
Like, yeah.
I don't know why, but this movie just screams end of 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, to get back into the framing of the movie, I mean, it's very much an ensemble movie, you know, simply about a bunch of students working their way through 4 years of high school at this prestigious performing arts high school in New York. And at the time, Madeline, you mentioned this is now known as LaGuardia, but this school was one of two schools that existed at the time kind of serving the same purpose. There was the High School for the Performing Arts, which is the one we hear about in the movie, and the High School for Music and Art, which was, I mean, I was not alive at the time. None of us were. I don't know how true this is, but it sounds like it's kind of the same thing under a different name.
Right.
In a different part of the city. And not long after the movie came out was when LaGuardia officially became the name, but it was a merger. High School for Music and Art and the High School for the Performing Arts merged into one building, which became known as Fiorello H. LaGuardia High School. For the performing arts is in the title. And that was opened in 1984, just a few years after the movie was released.
Very cool. I'll just say really quick, I basically didn't know anything about this movie either.
Ah.
Yeah.
What I'll say is that it kind of felt like one of those movies that I saw through osmosis,
mm-hmm.
because I do feel, and especially now having seen the movie, I can kind of confirm that in terms of tone and style and subject matter, it really does feel like it has this long shadow over the 80s. And I would mm-hmm. say beyond. Yeah. Like, when I saw this movie, I immediately noticed sort of thematic connections to another movie that we're going to talk about later, Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yeah.
But in terms of feel, I really also just think of Flashdance.
Oh, yeah.
Which
and
I
also
seen.
Definitely...
Which Irene Cara.
Yeah, exactly.
Also in Flashdance.
Uh-huh. And Footloose as well.
I thought a lot about Footloose.
I saw so many scenes of people's feet.
All
and I just...
the F titles, like movie titles that have dancing in them.
Absolutely, yes. But I think you could even go further. Like, I feel like this movie definitely feels sort of like a predecessor to a movie like Center Stage.
Yeah.
Mm. And I would even, if you bring it even closer to the more recent times, I think a movie like Glee, or a show like Glee, pardon me.
Glee, and even like High School
High
Musical.
High School Musical, I think. Yeah. So I definitely feel like this movie was something of a cultural flashpoint.
Yeah.
It's also, it's right in the middle of the Greases. Like, Grease is before this, but Grease 2 is after this.
Yes.
There's a Grease billboard that you can see in Times Square in I was just about to call it Hairspray in Fame. I was about
there
to call
are some
it,
similarities.
I was about to call it Hairspray because I'm looking at a list of comparisons in my notes. Where, interestingly, I mean, proving the point still, all of the movies I could think to compare this to were movies that came after it.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree with you.
Yeah.
I felt the same way.
Some of them are not strictly high school movies, though. Some of them are quite different, actually. And I'll go through this now and probably again later on. One other, not a high school movie, but a New York movie I had to think of watching this was After Hours, the Scorsese movie from 1985. Hairspray, of course, I thought about.
Yeah.
That's a little more directly relevant. I mean, we just talked about it, but Dazed and Confused. I had to think about that in some regards.
Yeah.
And then the other one, this might initially seem like a stretch, but I promise I can justify this one. Boogie Nights.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, what's your justification?
Yeah, what's your justification?
Well, it's mostly, it's not at all a similarity in milieu, but it is a similarity in the sense of the ensemble focus, the span of time that it covers, and the mix of the highs and lows of the experiences that happen for all the characters, that you have some characters experiencing their very best moments in direct tandem, in, at least in time, with other characters being at their most ignominious lows.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah,
totally. I think another movie that fits into that comparison is Nashville.
I feel like literally just
feel like we're
that.
Constantly bringing up Nashville.
Yeah, I think at some point we just have to talk about it.
Eventually we have to, or we just won't ever and we'll just tease it forever.
Yeah,
the white whale of this podcast.
Exactly. But for the same reasons that you're comparing it to Boogie Nights, it's like this big ensemble movie, but it also does like have this wide range of, I think, like emotional arcs for a lot of the different characters.
Yeah, well, that's one movie that comes before Fame.
Yeah, that and Grease.
But the moment during Fame when I immediately thought, oh yeah, Boogie Nights, it's a pretty obvious one.
It was, I think I know there's one.
Yeah, there's a scene when Leroy walks by a classroom wearing roller skates.
Oh, yep.
He rolls by a classroom. And yeah, I had to think, of course, of Heather Graham's Roller Girl in Boogie Nights, who is also a high school student in that movie.
I was actually also thinking, unfortunately, of another scene later in that movie. I do feel like the mixed media, kind of seeing it through a television screen.
Yeah, I
element
was thinking of that
also
too.
Ties into a very low from that film and
yeah.
a low from Fame. So yeah. You know what? The more we talk about it, Julian, the more I feel like this comparison is justified. Well done.
Here I am just, you know, quietly gloating about it. Thank you.
Of course.
I'm going to be more humble now. Thank you.
you're very welcome.
But yeah, so this is a movie that stretches its tendrils far ahead into the future after it's released. But yeah, I think that my familiarity with it was kind of similar to everyone else's here, that like I just knew it was a prominent movie. I think I had heard the song before. I kind of knew the tune of that, but just hadn't gotten around to it. But now we're here. And I mean, I guess it's kind of showing from the way that I and all the rest of us talk about it. I liked this movie a lot. I was really into it.
I thought it was fine.
Yeah. It was,
I don't know if I like really liked this movie. I think I appreciate what it did culturally and like you described. I think what it kind of set in place in terms of giving the film world kind of a like a prototype.
Yeah.
It creates a prototype, I think, for movies to come that I think do things pretty well too, I would say.
Yeah.
So I liked it. I had a good time with it. I can't say I loved it, but I liked it.
Yeah.
This is a movie that I really enjoyed watching. And then I feel like on retrospect, there are, like, it's certainly not a perfect movie. And there are things that I think could have been, you know, done a little differently and maybe are in movies that this ultimately influences. But I really enjoyed this. I came out of this thinking like this was so fun. And I think there and something I want to get to later, like I think there are a couple of really strong young performances in this.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely.
And yeah, I mean, one of the big points in this movie's favor for me too, has kind of nothing to do with the high school element. It's the New York element. I think it's a great depiction of New York at the time that it was made. I'm a sucker for New York on camera, not just as a New York native, but for the power that the city has on film. There's a way of showing New York that you just simply have to be here to do correctly. You
can't do it on a soundstage.
You can't do it on a soundstage. You can't substitute it.
You can't go to Toronto.
You can't go to Toronto.
Or Vancouver.
No. Right. Or even LA. They have sound stages in LA that are designed to look specifically like New York. I know this because the one time I went to LA, my folks and I took a tour of Paramount Studios, and we saw that they specifically had a series of sets that are meant to look like specific parts of Manhattan. There's like a Lower East Side street and like a Upper East Side, Middle East Side.
Gotcha.
Not that there is a Middle East Side. Well, it's a weird combination of words. But
all good. I'm following you. Don't worry.
Yeah. No, you have to be in New York to really capture it in a way that does justice to it. And I think it can be a bold move in the film world to do that in this, industry that depends on sound stages. And I think that, ironically, a lot of Fame was not shot in New York. A lot of the interiors were shot in Chicago. But for the exteriors, I thought it's just wonderful to see New York at that time. There's a lot of things the movie really gets right about New York, too,
that are still true
today.
I was reminded a lot of Midnight Cowboy watching this.
Oh, totally,
you kind of have that,
another
like...
another great New York movie.
That we've talked about.
We've talked about the young dreamer kind of coming to the city to make it big. And obviously, these kids have a much better and welcoming safety net.
Mm-hmm.
They're enrolled in a high school.
Well, many of them, not all
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, that's true. Although, I push back on it slightly on one front. But it's just like a grittier version of New York City. I think before Times Square, I think, kind of got Disney-fied, as a lot of people, I think, here like to refer to it as. But before it got really cleaned up, I mean, you're not quite there yet. You're still seeing a lot of remnants from the 70s.
Yeah.
The kind of stuff that you would see in a Midnight Cowboy or in Taxi Driver. We're not that far removed from it yet.
Even like being able to see like Montgomery's apartment, like that shot from the street, like with his window off in the distance and like the red light flashing. I love that shot.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Really, really.
It's amazing.
Cool.
Yeah. And I guess now, like, as the native New Yorker of the group, I'll talk a little bit about what I feel this movie gets right, not just about New York, but about high school in New York. And so, of course, this movie is shot and released roughly 30 years before I was even in high school. So it's far removed in time. But there were still some things about it that I think rang very true to me. And for one thing, the experience that you see throughout the movie of also this school that they're going to, that all the characters are going to, is meant to be on West 46th Street, which is in fact where the real high school for the performing arts was located at the time. Though, interestingly, they could not shoot inside the school or externally.
Yeah, the Board of Education took a lot of issue.
They did, yeah. They tried to do a lot to sway the optics away from them. I don't think it worked, and, praise be to Alan Parker and company for that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think, the Board of Education got it wrong in that situation. But still, the experience of being near that major hub and just kind of going out there casually for lunch... this area that people travel the world to see and you just treat it like that. That was one thing that rang very true to me.
Cool.
I went to high school not off of Times Square, but near Lincoln Center. Actually, I went to high school, though it is a broad corner, around the corner from LaGuardia. I mean, for listeners in New York who are wondering, I went to Beacon, the Beacon School, which at the time, it's since moved. It was located on West 61st Street when I was a student there. And the experience of just like, okay, you've got this time to hang around for lunch or whatever, and you go off to Columbus Circle or something like that. Very, very true to my own life. But also the experience in the school too of like that, the scene where I knew like this movie knows what it's doing was in that cafeteria scene early on.
Oh, yeah.
They all break out into song.
The hot lunch.
Yeah. And, well, that didn't happen to me. But,
no giant breaking out into song.
There were impromptu performances in my high school cafeteria, but wasn't so much like everyone was in unison. It was more like, a group of dancers would come in spontaneously and kind of flash mob it.
Gotcha. I think we went to high school before the flash mob really took off.
Yeah.
Emilio and I was more in college when that started to pick up.
Which tracks because, I think flash mobs were a big thing when I was in high school. And you would have been in college at the time.
Yeah.
Some overlap. But so that like that kind of thing did happen. There was a piano in my high school cafeteria.
Rad.
That's so cool. Yeah. So that can sort of relate to that, but it wasn't quite en masse in quite the way that Fame shows it. But still, the experience of everyone being crammed in the room and the stress of it, frankly, I mean, that felt very true too. Seeing Doris, the character, Doris Finsecker, walking in nervously to the room and kind of retreating after that's all happening, that's a pretty real feeling.
I think I've
been there before.
Yeah. I actually want to ask you guys about that scene. Yeah. What did you guys think about that scene? That, like, the cafeteria scene that suddenly just sort of becomes like a musical number?
I had a lot of fun watching it.
Yeah.
Honestly. I did too.
I enjoyed it a lot. Time.
I did too. I also felt like of all the scenarios that you could concoct that would spontaneously turn into that, this is probably one of the best ones.
Yeah.
Because you have a bunch of like try hard kids that like want to just, you know.
They all want to show off. They all want to be in the spotlight, be a center of attention.
Exactly. I thought it was really great. And I love too that point that you just made. I love how it ends. Mm-hmm. It literally ends with her leaving and just closing a door to it all, being like, I'm overwhelmed right now. I can't take this.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I belong.
Yeah. And I had times in high school when I felt overwhelmed by crowds and had to retreat to a quiet hallway or something like that. And then the experience of seeing her and Montgomery then eating in the stairwell together afterward, that's a very real thing that I experienced too. In fact, when my high school, when I was a senior in high school, my school was gearing up to move into a bigger building, so they were admitting more students than they could really contain. Mm-hmm. So the cafeteria was constantly overcrowded, and there was a great number of people eating in the hallways. And I often was part of that crowd, but maybe less because I strictly wanted to be in a hallway and more just because I wanted quiet.
Yeah, I feel like this is a trope that you sometimes see in movies of like the person who wants to get away from the chaos and finds another person trying to escape the chaos and they kind of bond. And I think it's very sweet.
Exactly.
Well done in this movie.
I made friends doing that kind of thing. Yeah. You know, many of whom I'm still friends with today.
Yeah, that's great. I did feel like that the movie really started to take shape in that moment.
Yeah.
It's another reason why I really like it. It's like that was kind of the little seed. Now, you know, we have all these people just congregated here, and suddenly we, the audience, have an opportunity to really focus.
Because the first, like, 20 minutes of the movie, maybe more?
The auditions?
Yeah,
auditions.
Are the auditions for the freshmen to get into the performing arts high school. And you meet so many characters in this time that you don't fully know who the main character, and I mean, there's not necessarily main characters, but you don't know who you're going to focus on. Like, there are some kids that you meet in that beginning audition scene, or in those beginning audition scenes, that you don't see that much of, like, who maybe have a couple of lines throughout the rest of the movie, you don't know who you're going to focus on. I think that this moment with Doris and Montgomery is one of the first times where you're like, oh, these two are going to mean something, which, like, Montgomery opens the whole movie. So like it is a fair assumption.
Sure.
But you're like, okay, we're back to these two. Yeah. We're pairing them up. Like and I like their friendship a lot.
Me too.
Yeah.
I feel like as I was watching the movie, I couldn't help but make the comparison that eventually when Ralph joins them, there are elements of the Dazed and Confused Tony and Claudia car.
Cynthia.
Yeah. Cynthia, thank you. That it sort of started to turn into that trifecta. And
but one thing we really liked about those three is that it seemed like there wasn't a romantic entanglement.
That's
and there certainly is here.
Yes, there is. There definitely becomes one in this
one. And one thing, we'll unpack this a little more later, but one thing I think that Fame really gets right about high school more universally, not just in New York, is the sense that in the very beginning of high school, everyone there is kind of meeting each other with equal opportunity. You don't know who your friends are going to be yet. And you like know a little bit about kind of everyone around you. But then as time goes on, you start to focus in on the people who really are your friends. And that group gets smaller, but more meaningful with time.
I want to speak to that, though, because that's actually not true to my experience.
Oh, like, interesting.
Just because, and I don't know what your, Emilio, experience is like, but, coming from a smaller town, I went to high school with the same kids that I went to kindergarten with. Like, I was not, I knew everybody almost going into high school because our high school only had one middle school that officially fed into it. So, like, the kids I was in class with freshman year were the kids I was in eighth grade with and seventh grade with and sixth grade with. You had a few kids who were coming in from private schools, but like I mostly already knew everybody that I was in high school with. And it is like, it is kind of this fresh start to a certain extent, but I don't know that there is this big restart where you're all starting in an equal playing field. Like there were already very much like there was a groundwork laid of like clicks and things like that.
I mean, there was a lot of carryover from the years before.
Yeah, well, maybe this is more distinctly a city thing then.
Yeah, I mean, so I grew up in Chicago, but really the kind of what essentially feels more like the suburbs outside of Chicago. And between middle school and high school, I transferred to a totally different school, and I was in public school until eighth grade. And then for high school, I actually went to a private school, and it was, I mean, there were elements, I think, of what they touch on here, which is just you kind of come in and you're kind of looking around and you're like, who do I get along with? Who seems like somebody I'd get along with? And so, yeah, there was a little bit of that. And I think that's a very universal aspect of making that next step in life is, you know, you're kind of coming in and you are leaning on the fact that everybody else is in the same boat to kind of get you through.
Yeah. Everybody is like trying to figure out how they're going to establish themselves and how they're going to like let these next four years play out.
Yeah.
I just think in my experience, like some kids kind of came in with a leg up socially
because they
were already like, you know, batting in the big leagues of eighth grade or whatever.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know what? And the high school that I went to was actually a first through 12th grade school. So there was, as you were describing, there were a whole number of kids that came in and went from eighth grade into ninth grade, and they all knew one another. And it's kind of funny because in some ways that plays into your hands if you are looking to socialize yourself quickly with people. But honestly, I would say that in some respects, it's kind of cool to be the new guy.
I kind of would have, I think, preferred to be able to just start fresh. Like, I feel like going into ninth grade, I had, you know, kind of fantasies of like, what if I just started over? Like, what if I just moved to a new school? And it wasn't that I like wasn't happy, but it's like, it's easier to go somewhere totally new where you don't really know that many people. Not easier necessarily, but I think the fantasy is easier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, yeah, like in my experience, going from elementary to middle to high school, there were a few people who went to all the same schools as me who I did know. But yeah, I think high school was probably the most different of the bunch from the prior schools. And it was a fresh start in many ways. And I mean, there was a relief to it. I mean, there were all these like nasty, toxic people I knew in middle school who I was very grateful to get away from. And some of whom I had known in elementary school, and, you know, just making the relief all the more palpable.
My mom talks about when she was, my mom grew up in the same town that she still lives in. My parents still live in the town that I grew up in. She talks about how when she was in high school, the city did this thing where they put all the ninth graders in the whole city together in one school where it was just like the ninth graders from all over the city, from every, what would have been every high school, all just in ninth grade together. And she always talks about how it was like the worst year of school.
Oh, no.
Because you had all these kids from like all these different neighborhoods who had these preconceived notions about each other.
Yeah.
And knew that they were only going to be together in school for a year. And so there was no reason to like establish yourself in any particular social circle.
Mm-hmm. That does sound frustrating.
Very weird. I don't know why my town did this in like 1975 or whatever.
But you talked about people coming in from different neighborhoods, and that gets to a broader aspect of New York high school life, which is you have people coming from across the city to attend different schools. This is not true everywhere in New York City. Again, Fame is about an elite New York City high school. So this is the type of school that people will commute all the way from the Bronx or from deep Queens or from deep Brooklyn to get to.
Sure.
What neighborhood do you think Doris is from? Like, she's from Brooklyn, but what neighborhood do you think she's from?
That's a good question. Because I am also a native Brooklynite.
I was going to say, you know way better than either one of us.
I'm asking this to you specifically.
I mean,
also 1980 Brooklyn.
There's a part of me that believes she could have been from Queens too, quite honestly. I'm not completely sure. I mean, I'm from Park Slope, and part of me thinks she could very well be a Park Slope kid.
The reason I say Brooklyn is I don't know that it's specified in the film, but I remember from reading on Wikipedia that Maureen Teefee's casting was not totally agreed upon by the production team because they The quote is that they envisioned her as a 16 or 17 year old Barbra Streisand from Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And when they cast this Irish actress, that was like that. There was a reservation there because they had the Babs picture.
Okay.
Honestly, I thought that was it Maureen Teefy. Yes. I thought she did quite a nice job playing.
I thought she was great.
A Jewish character at that.
Yeah.
But maybe by that metric, then maybe she's more like from like Midwood, deeper Brooklyn.
I was actually gonna maybe say that. I don't know why. I was also thinking a little bit of like in the maybe 70s or 80s. I have Bensonhurst in mind.
Well, I can see that.
Sheepshead Bay. Okay.
Yeah. Isn't Barbra Streisand from like Midwood or something like that?
Maybe.
Could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe somewhere in deeper Brooklyn.
Yeah. I really liked that scene, by the way. The one, what she, her mom kind of wrangles her into singing at a kid's birthday party.
Oh yeah,
or something along those lines.
Yeah.
I thought it was particularly funny because I do feel like that is a very relatable feeling if you have parents that are like, no, you know, look, you have some skills, and now what you need is exposure. Like now what you need is experience. And so you get roped into doing really uncomfortable and really
thankless.
Yeah. It's a great word. It's thankless kinds of quote unquote gigs. But I really like that touch. And I love how it cut straight to her giving like an improvisational monologue in drama class, being like, what did you learn? I hate birthday parties.
Yeah.
It was very good.
Yeah. But yeah, just thinking about like the commuting element in a New York City high school. I mean, that accounts for the diversity of a school like this too. And I mean, I think that's, you know, another thing that this movie gets right about New York is the different ethnic groups of people who you will see in one institution in a school like this one. And that's something, you know, it's accurate in portraying New York. It is something that this movie has over something like Dazed and Confused, too.
Mm-hmm. Which, I think that's a great point.
Yeah. And, you know, it's true about other high school movies, too. There are a lot more other high school movies out there where demographically the group of people who you see is more uniform. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but this is a way that Fame gets New York right. And I think that's a pretty good segue into one of the questions I've brought to this discussion, which is, I'll just read straight from my notes. As an ensemble movie, Fame presents us with a number of recognizable personality types, like with Dazed and Confused, but in a dramatically different setting. So do you think there are certain types of people in Fame who could only exist in a metropolitan environment? And do others strike you as more universal?
Yeah, I mean, I think this movie tries to find universal emotions out of a very particular type of young person. Mm-hmm. And I would say with varying levels of success.
Yeah.
I think at times it almost feels a little bit like the age-old chicken or the egg question, where in terms of drawing these, like what's drawn these kids into the arts? Because we do get a considerable amount of backstory on enough of them to see that they don't really have the best childhoods and that they are unpacking a lot of trauma. And so there is a little bit of that going on where it's like, you know, are these kids drawn to the arts because it's their way of kind of exercising like childhood demons? Or is that something that just anybody, you know, is, or that this movie is sort of posing to anybody who is interested in anything, any kind of, you know, life path, as a way of saying, no, like these people are relatable in ways that anybody could see. I was kind of seeing a little bit of that going on. Maybe that was just my own read, but I do think that there are some characters in here that feel a little bit more universal than others.
Yeah. Well, like, does anyone stand out specifically to you as being more universal?
I mean, I felt like Doris's character, I think, was the one that I felt like I related to the most.
I agree with that.
Which is sort of this idea that, like, you have talent. There's something about you. There's some innate drive in you to kind of go in one direction, but you just maybe don't feel like a lot of the people around you who are also doing that are people that you would be friends with. I get that. And then the other one, honestly, and this is a very, very small moment, but I heard it and it resonated so deeply to me, was Lisa, so the dancer. She's having a conversation with her dance instructor, and her dance instructor is basically telling her, look, you don't have what it takes and I'm cutting you from this program. And she says a line that I actually felt was extremely relatable and just really brought me into it. And what's that line?
I don't want to be the best. I just want to dance.
I love that line.
Yeah. I thought that was so, that really hit me.
Hit me too, in a big way.
Exactly. Yeah. It's even though like I have basically no dance experience. Yeah. I can resonate with that too.
Yeah. I mean, just, just with anything,
with anything and with art specifically, it's like so much of the time, particularly for these young people where it's like, you had to audition again, into the school. Like you should feel lucky to be here. Like you should feel lucky to be able to get this like performing arts education and you have to be the best. And she's like, I just want to do this thing that I love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love it too, because and that's something I feel very strongly about, you know, is, and my approach as a teacher, I think we all have different approaches as teachers, but one of mine is just, you have to meet people wherever they're at. And, and I do think that that's something that some teachers do kind of get wrong, is that not every student, even if they are in a performing arts school,
they don't want to be the best.
They don't necessarily want to be the best. And you know what? Newsflash, you don't always have to be the best.
Yeah.
There are other things that you can bring to the table that make you, you know, that can allow you to have careers in arts like that. And to say that you just want to dance, I think is, that's the pure intention there. And I'm with you. I just, like, that hit me and I was like, that was the line of the movie for me.
Yeah. And then, like, that kind of makes me think of, when it comes to teachers in the movie, my favorite by a big margin was Mr. Farrell, the drama teacher.
Oh, yeah. He gets a more screen time, excellent, I think, than most of them.
Yeah. So Mr. Farrell was an actual teacher, right, at the High School for Performing Arts?
Yes. And, yeah, he was the teacher I liked the best by a long shot, because he was one of the people, I think the only character who, right from the get-go, gives all of his students a realistic look at what their careers could be.
Oh, yeah.
He's telling them, ironically to the film's title, it's not all about fame, that many of these people are struggling to get by. A lot of them are on welfare, you know, working as waiters and waitresses. I can't quote him exactly, but he's basically saying that if you want to make it, good luck.
Yeah, yeah, I can, because I wrote it down. So, I mean, he said 10% of working actors make a living. Which I think by SAG's measures, that's still the case, as far as like the number of SAG actors, Screen Actors Guild actors who at least like make enough to be able to get like SAG health insurance every year, I think is like 10%.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's competitive out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that actually segues into a question that I had, which is like, as people who studied arts in some capacity, like, I absolutely had this conversation, like,
oh yeah,
and I imagine you guys did too. And it's, even before watching this movie, I separately had been having this conversation with Dougie. I was like, professors that teach performing arts do this thing where they feel like they need to prepare you for like the tough road ahead that I don't think happens with like biology professors.
That's true. Yeah.
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 Just wondering if you guys had also experienced that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's funny, because the people that I felt like were authority figures like that in my life were super transparent.
Yeah.
None of them, and to the point that you were saying earlier of admirable qualities in this character, nobody was like, you don't have what it takes, or, you know what, it's such a saturated market, don't even try.
Yeah.
Nobody said that. Everyone was just like, if you're going to do this, it's because you absolutely love it. It's because you would find it next to impossible to do anything else.
Exactly.
And yeah, and I think that's kind of one of the points he says. I also love, there's that little bit, and they just set it up beautifully, where he's like, this is the hardest path that you can take. And then the dance teacher's like, this is the hardest path. And then the musician, the music teacher's like, this is by far the hardest.
So, I like, that's a really good moment.
It is a very nice moment. I like that.
And I think that, but it's also worth clarifying with Mr. Farrell, the drama teacher, that he's not talking down to any of the students when he's saying this.
Absolutely,
he's doing it as a friend.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Almost as encouragement, as like, hey, you guys got the bug.
Yeah.
Let me tell you how it works in the real world.
Yeah. Like, let me just tell you now. Let me demystify this for you.
Yeah.
And yeah, if I were in school with that teacher, I would have been friends with him. Which kind of makes me think too about how in high school, sometimes the teachers who you become friends with aren't in your department. And like, I took a theater class in high school, but I wasn't like big into theater at that time. I mean, as you can imagine, it was music for me. But then I was thinking too about how like the music teacher in my high school was someone who, despite the fact that we were aligned, you know, in terms of the department, he and I didn't really click with each other. And I was just thinking about how like, you know, sometimes we did, but it was on and off. I kind of never knew what I was going to get from him. And weirdly, like, I think the teachers of mine who were my best friends as teachers in high school were science teachers.
Interesting.
And yeah, I mean, well, it's bringing me back to the question you asked about, like, do you think a biology teacher ever has prepared that conversation with the students?
And it's, be ready.
Yeah, I mean, I think about that a lot, that like in the arts, there's just that conversation is always there.
Yeah, you need to have some resilience as someone who's trying to pursue performing arts as a living. Mm-hmm. Like, you need to have like a reality check, I think, fairly young, because there's not inherent stability.
Definitely yeah. not.
And I think in a lot of ways, the movie's title is somewhat ironic.
Yeah.
Given the fact that it's called Fame, but it's focusing on all of these students in a period when that's not what they are. Mm-hmm. They're working towards it. That's the goal. That is the light at the end of the tunnel for all of them, but they're not famous yet. And the actors are made famous by being in the movie. But
yeah.
Still, yeah, there's a couple layers of irony there. And also at the end of it, like, the movie ends with graduation. Mm-hmm. You don't see what they go on to do. And I like that it doesn't do like that whole highlight reel at the end of like, so-and-so went on to do whatever. Like,
Warner graduated with no honors.
Yeah. It doesn't do like the Stand By Me thing.
Sure. No extra title cards to be like, oh, you know, this person, they made it. We believe, you know, we could believe in them all along or whatever.
You get hints, you get suggestions of what will happen, but you don't know for sure. It's a pretty ambiguous ending, honestly.
Yeah.
But kind of like to that point, the one character that we do kind of see a future of is Michael, because he's mm-hmm. a couple of years ahead of the rest of them. Like, he was a senior when our other more like main characters that we're following are freshmen. And we see that he, you know, when Doris first approaches him as he's about to graduate, and he's been like picked up by William Morris, and he's like going out to LA, and he's getting
feeling
like,
himself.
Yeah, he's feeling himself. And then she encounters him like 2 years later as a waiter.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's how it goes.
It's a little bit contrived, but one of the things that I thought played really nicely into that is they didn't play it as like, oh, look at this guy who's getting his comeuppance.
Yeah.
It really was more of just like, yeah, he was humbled. And
but he was still trying.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
He was like, I've got a call back tomorrow. Like, because that's the reality of a working actor, particularly he's what, like 20 at this point. He wasn't going to go out to LA and like film a pilot and have it get picked up. Like, that doesn't happen to most people. Yeah. This is what happens to most people. And to your question earlier, Julian, of like, who of the character types do you feel like is kind of universal? I actually don't feel like when we watched Dazed and Confused, I was like, I went to high school with all of these kids. I was like, I'm so familiar with these character types, and I'm so unfamiliar with the character types in this movie. Like, I don't feel like I knew any of these kids, but I did have the big dreamer and like big fish in a small pond kids. And even though New York is not a small pond, you could argue that Michael is the big fish in the small pond of the performing
of the
arts
school,
high school.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The school is like a pond in a gigantic ocean. It's like he's the big fish in the Carnival Cruise Line pool in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yes, exactly. So it's like when I think of types that I knew people who, you know, were massively talented and were working really hard and were like, I'm going to head out to LA and make it big. And then my dad will be like, oh, what happened to so-and-so? And I'm like, I have no idea. And he's like, wasn't he going to move to LA? And I'm like, yeah, he probably did. Have you seen him on TV? Like, that's because that's how it goes for most people.
Well, and one thing that this movie doesn't really have is like a counterpoint. It's like, you don't really have like the science. I mean, they kind of try to set it up with the English teacher, but they don't really have that. And so you don't really see this kind of point counterpoint between what is the talented performing arts kid versus the like bookish, nerdier types or whatnot. Like, right. You don't really see that. And I think in some respects, this movie is also kind of trying to put this type of student out front and center, because it's probably making the assumption in some respects, and I don't think it's a bad one, that this type of student is probably not as common as some of the other ones. And that might be a little bit of a stretch right now, but I do think that the movie does a couple things to sort of, well, just one big thing, which is it kind of likens the energy, or like the outsider energy of fans of the Rocky Horror Picture Show to these art students.
Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of that going on where you're like, oh, you know, you can kind of equate these kids sort of as like the people who would dress up and go to midnight movies, you know? And so there's a little bit of that where you're like, you are kind of, it's a little bit of tourism, I guess.
Sidebar. Yeah. Have you guys been to a Rocky Horror Shadowcast?
In college.
In college.
It happened every semester.
You're shaking your head no.
I never have. I've seen that movie twice though. Have you been?
I've been a couple of times.
In the city?
In the city. I went to one at the, what's the like the drive-in in like Williamsburg?
Nighthawk?
It's a drive-in in Williamsburg.
I was like, wow, I'm like, how is that happening?
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing.
It's right by the river. Anyway, I went to one there a couple of years ago, like right after COVID, when it was first finally safe to do things like that. And it's extremely fun, and we should plan to do that this October.
I'm down. Yeah. I really am. The first time I saw Rocky Horror, I was like, and the second time I was like, I get it.
I think it's
a communal experience.
It's a communal experience. Like so much of it. And I've been twice now, and it gets better every time. I also went to a place that did like a puppet show version of Rocky Horror last year, which is so fun.
That just immediately makes me think of John Waters.
John Waters.
Yeah. I mean, like, I have quite a history with the Rocky Horror Picture Show, given that my college, my alma mater, Sarah Lawrence, would show Rocky Horror Shadow Casts every semester.
Oh, really?
Awesome. Every semester.
So I think even in like March.
I think it was April some years, but yes. I think maybe one semester when I was there, they substituted that for The Princess Bride, which is also a big Sarah Lawrence movie. Yeah, and I don't know if they still do it there.
A big Sarah Lawrence movie. Is that
in what way?
It's not so much in Connections, if I remember correctly. It's just kind of, I don't really know why. It's just embedded in the culture of the school.
Somebody just really liked the movie and just insisted on screening it, and everyone else
followed suit.
So yeah, there was a yearly tradition to watch The Princess Bride on the North Lawn during orientation week.
Oh,
yeah. Wow. But there was also a semesterly tradition of showing a Rocky Horror Shadow Cast. So that part of the movie felt a little more like college to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, for sure. I could totally see that.
I strongly considered at one point auditioning to play Riff Raff.
Yeah, you would be a good Riff Raff.
I didn't do it because of scheduling conflicts, but I recalled that while watching Fame.
Dougie has done a stage version of Rocky Horror that he was, I can't remember the character name, but the one played by Meatloaf.
Oh my gosh, he played that?
Yeah.
That is hilarious.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to talk to Dougie about that next time we meet.
Honestly, like, just because of my abundant shadow cast experiences with that movie, I think the actual lyrics of the songs are not what's really in my head as much
as the callbacks.
And the one for the song that Meatloaf sings is, well, dirty to say the least.
Yeah, sure. That's actually, I think, my favorite song of the whole thing.
Yeah.
I like that one a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good one. I have a soft spot for the Time Warp, too.
Sweet
Transvestite. Yeah.
Of course, of course. Yeah. And Damn It, Janet, I think, is very good. Yeah.
Da, 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 da. Yeah.
Yeah. No, no. It's you know what's funny? The more we talk about it, the more I'm like, yeah, it's kind of good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the first time I saw it, I was like, and then the second time I was like, okay.
With people, it's good.
I know.
I think if you watch the movie like alone, it falls flat at some points.
Yeah. I watched it with my sister when we were younger. And my older sister. And I think there was a little bit of one of those things where she was a bit older than me. And I think it maybe kind of hit her a little better than it hit me. Mm-hmm. But then, I saw it in my 20s again.
Yeah.
And I got to ask, though, you guys are familiar with The Room, right?
Of course.
Okay. Yeah.
In all this time that we've talked movies, I've actually never asked you guys that question.
Not only am I familiar with that movie, so I considered playing Riff Raff. I dressed as Tommy Wiseau for Halloween one year.
Fantastic. Okay. Yeah. I was.
Oh, hi, Mark.
I'm just going to say right now that if we ever do like a midnight movie screening, that is one I've always wanted to do.
Me too, actually.
Yeah. That is a movie that you can see by yourself and it is still
just laugh your ass off.
Yeah, exactly.
It's been a long time since I've seen that movie.
Oh my god!
Also, a movie I saw the only time I've seen it was in college.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it since college. I watched it a lot with a lot of different groups in college, okay. And I think not since then.
Oh man,
yeah.
I think we got to do this, guys. That's a good one.
It's tearing us apart.
Oh my god! It definitely is. It definitely is.
The character in Fame.
What is it? Everybody betray me. I fed up with this world.
that's my favorite line. You've got the voice down.
Oh, no. I've watched this a few times. I love, he goes like, fed up with this world. It's very clearly he like 80 yard later.
Yeah.
But, you know, this talk about Rocky Horror and by extension, The Room has taken up a considerable chunk of our conversation, which is fitting because the Rocky Horror scene takes up a considerable chunk of Fame.
It really does. Yeah. And that's actually why I kind of brought it up. Because I do think that this movie is, I think it's trying to sort of situate these kids a little bit as like, yeah, these are kids that would welcome this.
With, you know, outsider tendencies.
Exactly. Yeah. Outsider tendencies. And also as a way of kind of humanizing them. Yeah. You know, it's like you kind of bring that in. And I do think in 1980, a movie like Rocky Horror Picture Show was sort of seen very fringe.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of a way to be like, yeah, well, like these fringe people are all like could be anybody in your life.
Yeah. And with this inclusion, I think another movie that, which is actually based on a book, but another movie eventually that maybe this influences is Perks of Being a Wallflower. That also has like Rocky Horror is a major section of that book and movie.
I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I read that book when it was like kind of a new thing. And I remember being drunk. Yeah.
I forgot the whole Rocky Horror thing entirely. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And yeah. So a lot of these characters that you see in Fame are not necessarily universal, but that's part of the charm in showing them on screen is that these are people that someone not from New York can get to know this way.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I also just in posing that question of who's universal and who's more site specific. I mean, some of the characters who struck me as a little more like New York City types specifically, well, Ralph Garcia was one.
Definitely.
Yeah. It's like not, I mean, I think his feelings maybe are a bit more universal, but the circumstances that generate them very much metropolitan city things.
Absolutely.
And just along with that, well, this is maybe less a city type, but someone who is specific, but definitely a type that you see in other places was Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
Of someone, you know, who is definitely privileged but has that absentee parent. And, you know, he has a certain freedom that, you know, a freedom financially that other people around him don't have, but he's closeted.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that feels like a very big move for this movie at its time that it comes out.
Yeah.
To showcase a character in, you know, to foreground him in that way.
Sure. I think this movie does do a lot to kind of bring somewhat uncomfortable thematic subject matter into it. I was also somewhat surprised, and not in a bad way, in kind of like, this is a movie we're watching, with some of the language. There is some like pretty into it language in this movie.
I was just going to say, talking about Montgomery, like one thing, I rewatched just like the first 20 minutes or so of this movie, and obviously the movie opens with him. It's his audition monologue that we start with. And even though I felt like I knew what they were doing, I think the idea is that you don't fully know if, like, when you first are hearing him speak, if this is a monologue or if this is just like him.
A conversation. With somebody far away from him.
It is an audition monologue. I'm not sure what it's pulled from. I don't think either of you guys know.
I don't. No. But I do, and I was very happy to catch another reference later in the film. Go ahead.
But I was just going to say that the monologue that he chooses does have a lot of similarities to his own experience where he's talking about an absent mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I was like, what does this say about the film that they choose to start with this monologue that is fiction, but clearly has been chosen by Montgomery, like very intentionally, because he felt some kind of connection to it.
Because of that framing of the character, I mean, I think the I mean, though it's not entirely similar, the closest character I could think of in film to Montgomery was actually someone from a very recent movie, and that's Angus from The Holdovers.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's another one with an absentee parent, though in his case, he's at a boarding school.
Yeah. Right.
So the absenteeism, I mean, it's a similar level of absenteeism, just in a different framing.
Mm-hmm.
And that Angus character is a noticeably angrier person than Montgomery is. And he's not closeted too. So that is, you know, that's another difference. Spoiler alert for The Holdovers.
No, but you know, to your point too, I think it also is there to show the audience as the film progresses that he is already in touch with this thing that his drama teacher is going to sort of impress upon the kids.
Yeah.
And whether it's because of his experience having a mother who's also an actress herself or not, he's really ready to go there. And he's also the first one, I guess, when he's talking with Doris to be like, I think I'm ready to actually come out of the closet or like talk about the frustrations that he has about being like, people told me it was just a phase and this, that or the other. And so he has the spirit of somebody who, you know, we quote unquote associate with an actor, like the openness, the willing to dig into that.
Yeah.
Whereas other people, I would say maybe Doris and then especially Ralph, I think for them, it's the movie and their 4 years in that school is more about them finding that in themselves.
Yeah, it's like they really have to be pushed there. They, I think, want to keep themselves separate from their art to a certain extent. Yeah. And I think Montgomery, for whatever reason, knows early on that in order for your art and particularly your acting to be authentic, like you need to draw from your own experience.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And I wrote down just a couple of random fun lines that I enjoyed a lot, but one that I think relates to this is from Doris, where I forget the exact context where Ralph is annoying her and she says, I must remember this feeling and use it in my acting.
I love that line so much.
Yeah.
It was really well delivered and it also rang so much like a young person.
Absolutely.
Who is like, oh my God, this is so awful, but what an incredible experience. You're like, I have a golden opportunity with this.
Yeah. And just as you were talking about Montgomery, my mind started drifting to Leroy a little bit. Not that they are exactly similar people, but I think that with Leroy, there's kind of an understanding that he knows what he's good at. And when he's in his dance classes, like he can really shine there.
Yeah.
And that he's already like in touch with that side of himself enough that he knows these other classes are useless to him.
Right, right, right.
And so it's...
Yeah, he even, towards the end, he's like gotten an offer, right, for a company.
For Alvin Ailey.
For Alvin Ailey, which is, that's about as good as he can get.
Yeah.
It's about as good as he can get right there.
Yeah, and he's like, they won't let me join if I don't graduate.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And I don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
I
mean, maybe they did have that kind of standard, but it's, I mean, it is a fitting culmination in that conflict with the English teacher that he has throughout the movie. And I thought that English teacher too, though she's not a particularly likable character, I did think that was another accurate character.
It's funny, at the very beginning, I like her a lot. Like I think she's the same teacher that he originally has like the first interaction with at the audition, because she's the one that makes him check his knife.
That's true.
And I interpreted it as kind of playful, where she's like, here are the rules, you have to follow the rules, but she's also kind of giving him a smirk.
Yeah.
But then as soon as he's in her class, like, I mean, it kind of goes, their relationship quickly goes downhill.
Yeah.
I'm going to say though, too, one of my big nitpicks is, and I understand that this movie is sort of here to revel in drama and create situations for these kids to be particularly dramatic. You are getting expelled if you cause that much property damage.
That's true.
Oh, yeah.
Like, full stop.
That's what
it is.
For
it,
sure.
It's happening. So, sorry, Leroy, like, He gets an enormous pass in all of this.
And it's true.
And I'm also like, I don't know exactly how many teachers they have at this school. It seems like she's his English teacher the entire time he's in high school.
Yeah.
That's not very accurate either.
Maybe it is in some schools, but by the end, he's like begging her to pass him. Supposedly she's passed him 3 times. Like, right? Yeah.
This is a very good point. Also, you have to read in other classes.
Yeah.
That's
right?
True.
It's true.
I'm sorry. I mean,
yeah, interesting. What you could make a case for is that, well, maybe this is more true of performing arts departments, but often there you do have the same teacher all 4 years.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I was like, maybe this is accurate, but I clearly, like, it, even if he did take her class all 4 years, she has passed him three times at this point.
Right.
Yeah.
And I just want to go back and quickly say that I think the assumption is that while he's not good at reading, it is something he can kind of do.
Yeah.
And that hopefully in the 4 years that this movie takes, that shows you that he's gotten better at it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that his attitude towards classes outside of dance have gotten to the point or to the place where he is putting the kind of effort in that would allow him to pass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry. I think I got kind of hung up on that as like that being one of the, his character, one of his defining character traits, but
yeah, but
and even dance, he refuses to wear the tights. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. he's a rebel.
Yep.
But yeah, then that Mrs. Sherwood character, the English teacher, I mean, one of the things about her that is unpleasant to watch, but I do think is kind of accurate is that, well, she's racist. That, like, the fact that it's, you know,
I'm trying to remember what, when,
she, like,
when does it happen in the movie?
A book at him. She, like, yeah,
she mocks his slang.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And,
right. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And it's now, like, I haven't seen all of these qualities in one teacher before, but the circumstance of a white English teacher correcting a black student's slang, I have seen that in person before. Mm-hmm.
I've seen that too.
Yeah.
I've seen that too.
And then, like, she, she throws Othello at him and it's like, read this, he's black. He's black.
That, right, that I thought was genuinely an offensive moment on her part.
Yeah.
And I think, like, in this day and
1980.
Age, that was 1980. Yeah, I think there would be a scandal right away if that happened.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Someone would have their phone out.
That teacher would get canceled right away.
Yeah.
In the parlance of our times.
Right. Or suspended, and their life would look very different after that.
Yeah. But also just like more broadly in her character, the sense of her being someone who is very educated and knowledgeable about what she teaches, but is not streetwise.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a familiar type too. But, it's, you know, I feel like you see it a little more with English teachers than with other subjects. Like, I think in science departments, you see teachers who are like not street smart, but they know it and they embrace it. They kind of are like, you know, they have their nerdy prog rock side project that they're doing.
Yeah, like, right, absolutely.
Outside of class. So it's like, oh, by the way, everyone. Yeah, like they have.
By the way, I have an all-ages show.
Yeah, they have inside jokes with the students and stuff like that. But I've seen that with English teachers before where they are not streetwise and they are weirdly proud of it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
What I'll say, though, is I think she's in the semi-uncomfortable position that her class is seen as second or third tier in all of her students' lives. And that has got to kind of suck.
That's absolutely got to suck. And I feel like is the opposite from most school, like from non-performing arts school. Like I came from, like I've taught in, not in high school, I taught in middle school music for 4 years in my former life. And there was very much this like kind of implication of like you're an other, like you're a less important subject, like music and art, like you're kind of there to babysit. Like the kids loved it. The kids got a lot out of it. But from like the administration and from the other teachers, there was always this sort of like, oh yeah, the arts teachers.
Right,
like,
right.
And I'm like, man, I mean, obviously teaching in a performing arts high school, I'm sure comes with a lot of pressure and a lot of its own challenges. But I'm like, how nice to be respected as a subject in a way that I never felt when I was teaching in school.
Yeah. I believe that. I totally see that.
Yeah. Yeah, I could understand that too. Yeah, I don't think I really saw that kind of validation among teachers until I was in college. And even there, at a school that covered more than just performing arts, they still sometimes felt like they were thrust to the side too.
Oh yeah, even, sure. I mean, even like among students, I think in college, sometimes like I had a friend who said she didn't want to date a music major because she wanted someone with more ambition.
Ooh, yeah.
That,
I mean, there
that
are
hurt to say to me a music major.
Of course, of course. Oh man.
I mean, but where is that friend now, though? It's an interesting question to compelled.
Or
to
maybe
ask.
Not even just where is Zepris, but how fulfilled are they?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I think that people just have, particularly when they're young, these preconceived notions of like what ambition is,
mm-hmm. and it's right. like, or what it looks like, or
and yeah. like what you want out of a partner or whatever. And, actually, and like, I think these things evolve over time as people mature.
Sure.
That brings me to another point about a character who we have not talked about yet, which is Bruno Martelli, who honestly, of all the characters in this movie, I probably personally found the most relatable.
Oh yeah, he's cool.
Yeah, it's, you know,
he's someone I would want to hang with, I think.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, I guess the way his immersion in music was certainly a relatable thing for me. I was very into prog rock when I was in high school, so I mean, mm-hmm. seeing him come in with that Keith Emerson worthy keyboard setup.
Yeah, maybe that's where the Alan Parsons comes in.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't play keyboards in high school. I didn't have that kind of setup, but I felt a connection
oh,
to
for
that
sure.
character.
Yeah, yeah. You're coming in with like a couple pedal boards.
I wasn't even doing that. I've never been like a big equipment guy gotcha. When it comes to playing. It's but in terms of like being a nerd about music.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Very yeah. much. Yeah. The other things I found relatable about him. So there were two things that came up actually in that scene when his dad is driving him home in his cab. And one of them is like, you know, it's like you've got to perform more. You've got to show your music to the world. And I like the way that Bruno's pretty reserved about doing that. I can relate to that a lot. And it's not, but what I could see in that character was that it's not stage fright. That's not the concern. It's more of this sense of like,
it's like a philosophical.
It's philosophical. Yeah. Like I want to wait until I have something I'm proud of to show the world.
He wants it to be ready. I think it's also that scene where there's another line that I love and wrote down, which is maybe I die undiscovered and my ghost gets the Grammy.
That is good. Yeah. Right. Cause he keeps talking about, he's like, did I do all that for a ghost? You know?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I recently watched the De Palma movie Phantom of the Paradise. And
that's a great one.
I love that movie. It's so much fun. It almost feels like the lesser known and better Rocky Horror.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, yeah.
I haven't seen it, but
I think if you should mix like I'm Rocky sure, yeah. Horror and like Suspiria together,
yeah,
then you yeah. get Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah, I feel like I would really like that.
But Bruno, I've
seen a ton of Brian De Palma movies. I just haven't seen that one.
Yeah, Bruno kind of made me think of the main guy in that movie.
Yeah,
as, like in the sense of his vision, his musical vision.
One thing I was going to say about his character, though, that I thought was kind of funny and just resonated a lot with me was the whole line where his friend Coco, who mm-hmm. you know, is coming in and she's like, hey, look, you know, there are ways that we could do this and make money. And I just, in my mind the whole time, I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm like, you can take these gigs and you can still focus on your own stuff, but you can pay for all this gear yourself.
Yeah, totally.
And I was like, I just wanted to reach into, you know, the TV and just kind of shake him and be like,
you know, please,
it's cool. There's good money in playing cover music.
Yeah.
and a lot of fulfillment, to be honest. I love playing cover music. So
one of the other things when it comes to Bruno that I personally found very relatable about him, and this is like a throwaway moment. This is like a blink and you miss it sort of line, but his dad for a moment calls him out about his lack of dating life.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It just says, you know, it's like something like I had girlfriends when I was your age.
Yeah, I had a
like
different
that.
One every day or something. Yeah.
And the way that like Bruno struck me as at points in the movie kind of an aromantic character. And I mean, for reasons that I started to get into the last time we all sat down, I could relate to that.
Sure.
Yeah, of
sure.
being someone like I didn't date anyone in high school. And it's, you know, it took me a while to understand that if you're not dating someone at a certain time in your life, there's no shame in that.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like a character flaw or
Our
anything
culture
like that.
Creates a lot of pressure around romance, and mm-hmm. I think particularly with young people, like so much of the media that's targeted towards young people and the movies and the television and the music is all about love and romance.
Exactly.
And yeah, I think you kind of have to unlearn that.
Yeah.
And I think this movie also, it's funny because it presents that and it totally, you know, creates like a pretty cool, well-rounded character out of it. But it also kind of goes the other direction too. It's more than happy to, you know, delve into some of the burgeoning sexual nature of some of these kids. I also couldn't help but think of the movie Porky's. This movie,
which I have not seen.
This movie has a couple of scenes of boys who are peeping into the female dancer's dressing room. Mm. And while those are two wildly different movies, I couldn't help but think, when I'm trying to think about the influence that this movie had on the 80s, I couldn't help but think of Porky's.
Yeah.
Because Porky's, that's like one of the big sort of narrative points in that film is peeping. And this movie's got a bit of that too.
There's some peeping.
But it also, it specifically, I think, gets at some of the nature of that with Leroy and Hillary. Is that her name? The dancer?
Yes.
Yeah.
Leroy and Hillary, which I thought was actually really well played, which is the whole thing where, like, when you're young and you like are excited, you know, to be with another person, sometimes you just like can't keep your hands off one another. And this movie kind of did like a nice job of demonstrating that, but also not going like overboard. It just kind of like did it, and it made it a really small detail that felt also very like cool. This movie kind of knows, I think, what's going on with young people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's to that point, actually, I noticed that this is something that Fame has that is not true with a lot of high school movies, is that a lot of the actors are actually close in age to their parts.
Yeah. Mm. And I think a couple of them had been students at this high school.
They had, yeah.
Antonio Franceschi, who plays Hillary, and then also Jean Anthony Ray, who plays Leroy, they had both been expelled from this school for different reasons.
Oh. Yeah.
I think Jean Anthony Ray, I think, had some behavioral issues.
Yeah.
And then Hillary has an interesting story that she was essentially expelled because she took a part in Grease.
Mm.
So she has like a very, I think, minor like background dancer role in Grease, and apparently like she was not allowed to continue at the school for that reason or something.
That
like
seems
that.
So contrary to how a school would want to do that. You'd be like, like, look,
it's just, you
our
know,
students, you know, have early success or whatever. You think that they'd want to.
It's an institution at the end of the day, and it's more like, you know, we want this person.
Right. Yeah. Or like, it's we create the rules, and they feel incensed if for people feel like they think that they're above them.
Yeah. There are some people in this movie who it seems like their portrayal on screen is somewhat, if not very close to their real life. And it seems kind of like Leroy relating to Jean Anthony Ray. Like Jean Anthony Ray was pretty similar to that in real life.
Mm.
But also, I mean, sadly, also that's also true about the scene where you see him struggling. Well, not the in the semi-illiteracy sense, but in that scene where he is trying to read and he's like underneath a bridge,
right?
In like this, what would you call it?
Like a pretty rundown part,
urban
of
wasteland.
Yeah.
That there were points in his life when I think that he was homeless and sleeping on streets, sleeping on park benches and stuff like that. And I mean, you know, his like the way his story ends is sad too, because he passed away from AIDS.
Mm.
Yeah. Wow. I was looking through the Wikipedia and there were a few people involved in this movie who passed away specifically from AIDS. I think he was the only actor, but that one of the, I think the writer or composer did as well. I'm looking through
Gore,
it right now.
Michael Gore?
Christopher Gore.
Christopher Gore, pardon
me.
Yeah,
the screenwriter.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then Irene Cara does not die from AIDS, but she does, she did pass away about 2 years ago.
Yeah pretty recently. Yeah.
Yeah, still, you know, I think she was in her 60s, but still young to die. Well, yeah, I guess maybe now, like, we're talking about some of the individual actors. Maybe now's a good time to talk about, like, kind of the careers of them more broadly.
Yeah, I had a question, which was, like, you know, when we talked Dazed and Confused, we were like, there are a couple of actors in this movie that just blow up to an unbelievable degree, like Matthew McConaughey and Ben Affleck and others, and you don't really see that.
Yeah, you don't really get that from this movie.
You don't get that from this movie. And it's like some of these people do go on to have relatively fruitful like stage careers, like moderately successful. Mm-hmm. But nobody from this movie becomes a household name. And like, why do you think that is? Like,
it's interesting.
And is there anybody from this movie based on these performances that you're like, that person should have blown up way more than they did?
I think if there's anyone who you can argue became a household name, it's probably Irene Cara. But even she, it's
I mean,
like,
yeah, I mean, I know her voice from these songs, from the theme of Flashdance and from this song.
Yeah,
but it's
kind of a two-hit wonder.
Yeah.
With some of these other people, what's interesting when you consider the message of this movie is that it seems like a lot of them did become steady professionals in the arts.
Yeah,
but not famous, really.
Right, right.
So maybe they really were living that vision that Mr. Farrell set out of struggling for years. You know, maybe some of them were struggling before fame. And then just kind of, you know, working steadily. It's not about them being a big name. It's just about them doing what they love consistently. It's like they don't have to be the best. They just want to dance.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, I love that. That's great. I mean, I was going to say that I felt like the two characters whose stories I think had the largest arc, oddly enough to me, I felt like were actually pretty good. Like I thought Maureen Teefy, I thought she was really good. Yeah. I mean, this felt like the kind of movie that you get that you are in before you then take another project that gets really big.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're like, boy, you have a career.
Well, if Grease 2 had blown up to the extent of the original Grease, then
maybe that would have happened. Yeah. We'll talk about that more soon, I'm sure. I was going to say the other guy who I thought was honestly like pretty good, even though I felt like there were some moments where it seemed like he was kind of dialing it up a lot, is Barry Miller.
He's who I have written down. Yeah. I'm gonna let you continue, but I want to
No. You can go. All I was just gonna say is I felt like his character has the longest arc, and it's like he goes from being completely kind of he's kind of the smart alecky one who is trying to make everybody laugh ostensibly because he is kind of trying to hide his own pain and whatnot. And he goes from being unliked to liked and kind of in the circle, and then kind of like maybe goes a little bit over his skis a bit, but he has like this really long arc and he does a great job with it.
Yeah, totally. I think he is phenomenal in this movie. Like he was absolutely my standout performance that I'm like, I hate that he didn't blow up more because I think he's so good in this. And part of it is because he has this really fulfilling arc that allows him to tap into like different emotional like resonance. Like he has like, I think it's two different really emotional monologues that I was 100% bought into each time. He also does the comedy set, two different comedy sets. One that's like killing.
Yeah. Like his comedy set is awesome.
Yeah. And I'm like, wow, legitimately good. I was like, his delivery of that first comedy set is so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I would totally pay to go see somebody perform that.
Exactly. Yeah. But then he also has to act the bomb later where he's giving the same set, but it's bombing.
Yeah. Yeah. And he also, and one of my favorite scenes with him is, and it's probably maybe one of my favorite shots in the movie, which I think is like a Steadicam shot of him and, oh my goodness, I'm forgetting her name, Doris, pardon me, who, and they're in the subway and they kind of just follow them down across and then down the steps and then right along to the subway. It's a really beautiful shot.
One thing about that scene though, it's, I mean, maybe, you know, we've talked about the guitar index, the guitar playing index.
We're going to get
on
that
later.
We're gonna
but I think we can also start a New York City subway index.
Yeah. Okay.
Because, I mean, I thought in that scene, so last summer, I went to a screening of The Taking of Pelham 123 at the Film Forum, which was preceded by a short documentary by, I think, one of Film Forum's directors that was about the representation of the New York City subway on screen. And he points to a scene from Death Wish, which happens in the same station, Times Square, 42nd Street, where Charles Bronson is about to confront a man in an empty section of the ACE platform area. And then that Film Forum director pointed out, that part of the station has never been so empty.
That's true. That is a very empty.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's I had to think the same thing. Like, I love the New York subway on camera, but during that one scene in Fame, I was like,
There would be at least a couple people milling around.
Sure. Yeah.
No, but you know what? But that he is so, like, he is on the highest of highs.
Yeah. And he's like, I'm going to make it big and we're going to get married.
Yeah. And, and it's like, and he plays it very convincingly.
And you get to win 12 Tonys or whatever.
I'm also going to say this.
Funny you mentioned that.
But another thing that happened in that scene that seems so small and is also really dialed in to how dumb you are when you are like a high schooler is the very end of that sequence.
Oh my God.
Do you remember when he says something like, don't get raped? And then she's like, I'm going to rape you. I'm just going to say this. When you are like 16 or 17, say dumb shit like that.
Yeah,
you
absolutely. Do. And, that feels and, like something as 16
and it's not old. Something that I'm like proud of, but you say dumb stuff and And I, honestly, that moment, like, I was like, yeah, that sounds like something that a 17-year-old would just say.
Totally. It's true, yeah.
I thought you were going to say how they both kiss the window of the subway, which is disgusting.
You're right. Yeah, but stranger things have happened in New York.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is true. Yeah, just, I mean, we mentioned about the language of the movie earlier, that that's something this has over a lot of other high school movies. That is that, you know, the harshness of the language, that's very real. I feel like, I mean, you know, it's, we'll see what we think with other things we talk about. I feel like Dazed and Confused was pretty good about that, too.
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah.
Just in a different part of the country with people who, you know, casually talk in different ways. To go back to Barry Miller for a moment, though, I mean, when we talk about the careers that actors in this movie had, I mean, he maybe is not the biggest name, but he did win a Tony only 5 years after Fame for Biloxi Blues. So that, and
which is a famous production, by the way. You guys know why?
Yeah, with Matthew Broderick.
Because Matthew Broderick and Alan Ruck were both in that.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And they also teamed up in Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Speaking of high school movies.
There you go.
With Barry Miller, though, I mean, he's also one of those people who seems to have had quite a career before Fame, too.
Yeah.
That I think he was cast because, I don't remember this movie well enough to remember his part, but because of a compelling role in Saturday Night Fever. I mean, when you look at his credits, I mean, Saturday Night Fever is probably the biggest thing pre-Fame, but there's a lot. He had been working since 1973, and he was still like only he was college age at the time that Fame was being shot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like, I don't know, it feels like there was something like that we missed out on like a 5 year post-Fame career where he would be like, I don't know, like a William Hurt. I mentioned William Hurt before, where you're like, oh, you know, they're kind of vying for the same roles or whatever.
Yeah.
Or I'm trying to think of another comp of some kind of his, but like...
Like in that time?
Yeah, period. In that time, like he could have been in The Outsiders or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Like Ralph Macchio.
It's something along those lines. Like he could have been right in the mix with all those guys.
I just feel like he kind of falls off like as an actor. Like if you look at like his more... He hasn't had an IMDb credit in 20 years. And he is still alive, as far as I can tell. So it's like he had a bit of a fruitful career pre-Fame, like as a young person, and then goes on to, have some success on stage and wins a Tony, and does work fairly consistently through the 80s and 90s, and then nothing. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if he became a high school teacher.
Maybe.
Maybe.
That's interesting.
Maybe life came full circle. Or maybe he's living off of Saturday Night Fever and Fame residual checks.
Interesting.
Or he's doing something else and being a wonderful contributing member of society. Yeah, if you're out there,
Barry Miller, email
Barry Miller,
us.
Let us know, man. We absolutely loved you in this movie.
You're so great.
Yes, and I mean, so are a lot of other people in the movie Fame. To anyone else from Fame who potentially hears this, we see you too.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah, we see you. We appreciate you.
I want to, on the subject of seeing you and also hearing you, you mentioned the guitar playing accuracy index.
Oh yeah,
it is note for note perfect.
Note for note perfect.
It was great. Yeah. Well, apparently he...
Note for note perfect.
That's an original song of his.
Of his?
And we're talking about Montgomery now.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. It's like it's an original song written by Paul McCrane that I think he played at his audition.
Yeah.
For the movie. Yeah, the movie. It made it in.
He is playing every voicing, I think, like right to perfection. It reminded me a lot of a Bee Gees song.
Yeah.
Like it sounded a lot like How Deep Is Your Love.
Yeah,
or something.
Now that you say that, I can hear that.
Yeah.
But fitting for the time, too.
It was great, though. Like, he, to me, like that is the high watermark of guitar playing.
Yeah, he's the gold
accuracy.
Standard.
Yeah, so in our index. Yeah. And also, it's like.
It'd be hard to beat that.
The things he's playing there are not easy, too.
No.
I noticed that. He's not just strumming open chords.
He's moving seamlessly between some pretty different bar chords.
Yep, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
At that, there were like some C-shape voicings
in
there.
I saw a C-shape voicing of the five chord.
That is not easy stuff.
No. And he's got a great use of a secondary dominant and an augmented chord. Some nice chromaticism.
Exactly.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah, for listeners who have not already picked up on it already, we are musicians.
That's true. Yes, yeah. No, but I mean, it just has to be said that this guy's at the top. He is.
Absolutely.
He's the leader in the clubhouse right now.
Sorry, Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
That's true.
I mean, maybe we have to do a piano playing index and look at him in La La Land in that way. Funny enough, I actually thought about La La Land for a different reason in considering this movie. Because of a specific scene, which I think we've talked about off mics, but not on mics yet, which is the street dance scene. Wait, no, we talked about that on the mics.
Very briefly, yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, the street dance scene.
Love it.
Where, yeah, it's a wonderful scene. I think it's the natural companion to the cafeteria scene. In that scene, in reading about it, apparently the need to hold off traffic to film it meant that there was a 4 p.m. curfew in filming for that scene, which made me think of how in La La Land that Damien Chazelle had to shut down an L.A. highway to shoot that opening scene.
Oh, yeah. That's a single shot.
A single shot scene, yeah, that involved shutting down, a very busy highway in L.A. It all makes me think, too, of in 28 Days Later, the way that Danny that Boyle had to hold off Piccadilly Circus.
To me, that is an iconic shot. I saw that movie in theaters,
yeah,
and that shot was like, how did they do that?
Yeah.
Another one that's famously like that is Cameron Crowe shut down Times Square for Vanilla Sky.
Oh, interesting.
And that's another one that's like you see and you're like...
just a few blocks over.
You're like, how did they do that? Because it is literally dead.
Today they just CGI it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Nope. This is true. Everything's got to be in camera these things happen.
But then when you see like the other driver barking at Bruno's father.
I need to know what happened to Bruno's father. Is he in prison?
He's a great dad.
He is a great dad. We love him.
I really like how much he believes in Bruno. And maybe he puts a little too much pressure on Bruno. And like, you know, Bruno's dad and Doris's mom like have both put some amount of pressure on their kids.
Yeah.
But it does seem like it's from a place of like, I just really believe in my son. And he is really good.
And I like how he does it. He doesn't involve his son necessarily in what he does to promote him.
Yeah.
He does it by just putting the tapes on in his cab. Yeah. So it's really cool. It's like his son doesn't even really know that his dad is doing it. It's kind of his dad's way of showing his love and kind of being there for his kid. Mm-hmm. So I'm with you. It's really cool.
Yeah.
One quick thing I did want to say though, and this is just from a personal place, listening to Bruno's dad in that scene, the kind of dance mob scene. So this actor, apparently he has a nickname, Mr. Gravel, because he has a particularly raspy voice that has made him a good amount of money, like as a voiceover actor and whatnot. But my God, listening to this guy barking his lines, it just sounded like he was shredding his voice. What we were seeing was like the 50th take of him just blowing out his chords. Mm-hmm. And it's like even more, he's even more kind of like boisterous than you would normally see like a stereotypical NYC cabbie type be. Mm-hmm. As somebody who has recently had vocal surgery, my heart just cries out to him, like, get some vocal rest, please.
Yeah.
It's funny that they call him Mr. Gravel, too, because I just recently saw John Waters' movie Desperate Living.
Oh, yeah.
In which Mink Stoll plays a character named Peggy Gravel.
Awesome.
Yeah. So it's like,
Marble Gravel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We know he is a world-class name bestower.
Yeah. So, you know, what is it? Metamorphic igneous rock that he's just drawing from all those things.
Nice. Yeah. Eddie Barth, for some reason, is like top listed on IMDb.
Yeah. Probably. Alphabetical, maybe?
Yeah.
Alphabetical by last name. I do think that is it.
Okay.
It
like his last name, unshortened, is kind of like the Italian version of my last name, Bartholetti.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Maybe you're...
Is that an Italian, like an actual Italian name?
Barthold, my name? No, it's not Italian.
No, I'm saying but his Bartholetti. Name.
Yes. Well, yeah. Okay, I mean, cool. It looks like it. I would assume that's what it is.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm actually not looking at what you guys are looking at.
Yeah, I'm looking at Wikipedia right now.
I'm on IMDb. I just wanted to point out that he also, you mentioned that he has a fruitful career as a voice actor, and he does a voice in Babe, Pig in the City, which is like the Babe sequel. Have you guys seen the Babe sequel?
I've seen neither movie.
I've seen Babe, and I love Babe. I've not seen Babe 2. You know who rode to his death for Babe 2, Pig in the City?
Who is that?
Gene Siskel.
Love that.
Yeah. He was like, he gave that movie like the most glowing review. And he was just like, this is the best movie of the year.
He was not a fan of Fame.
That's true.
Ebert was the one of the two.
Ebert loved it. Yeah.
He endorsed Fame.
Yeah. Babe, Pig in the City, I do not think is very good. Dougie loves, I'm not a huge fan, but I love the first Babe.
Yeah, me too. The end of the first Babe to me is like, gives me chills just thinking about. Yeah.
Sure. You've got to watch Babe.
Jim. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's quite good. It's quite good.
But yeah, that actor Eddie Barth, I mean, just looking at his face, it looks like he could have been a runner-up for Columbo.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yes. Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, just hearing in a raspy voice him saying just one more thing.
Yeah. Are there any other small details that we want to maybe address that we kind of dug about this movie?
One fun thing that I noticed that, given present circumstances, is very relevant. There's a throwaway moment at the beginning of that cafeteria scene as it's just showing quick shots of people around the cafeteria where you see one kid immersed in Dune. And that is very relatable for me because as of this recording, just last week, I was doing the very same thing to prepare for watching Dune Part 2.
This past weekend at time of recording is when Dune Part 2 was released.
Yes. But also, I mean, what's funny about that too, and can be spun into a larger point about the school that this movie is focusing on, is that the lead actor of both Dune movies, Timothy Chalamet, is a graduate of LaGuardia High School.
There we go.
Yeah.
And it all comes full circle.
It's very prescient that, I mean, and also for people who have read Dune, the word prescient comes up a lot in that book. It is very prescient that this should be shown in the movie Fame 40 some years before the movies star someone who went to that same school.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. How about you?
I have a small detail I like. So we, in our last cycle, we talked about Coda. And I took some issue with the choir teacher and Coda.
I think we all kind of did, but yes, you definitely.
For various reasons, a lot of which had to do with accuracy. And one thing that I really loved, you get some shots of the choir in a few different parts of this movie. You had mentioned the scene earlier where Leroy is like breaking shit and like breaking glass. You've got like the choir singing over him at that point. You also get the choir, I guess, at the graduation. Mm-hmm. They have great vowels. Like, and they, I can tell that like, this was probably like the choir from the school. I mean, I don't know that for sure, but like, I imagine that a lot of these choir kids were probably like students, either at that or like a similar, another performing arts high school or like a local choir in some way, because they just have these like incredibly tall vowels that are like really drilled into you as a choir singer for blending purposes.
Cool.
And I just noticed that every time they shot to the choir, it's like,
yeah,
it's like all the way you're to the floor.
You're demonstrating that right now. Yeah, that's cool. On that note, you were talking about the kind of overlapping sound in the film.
Yeah.
That was something that I thought was really cool. It was a really neat little detail. I felt like the sound design of this movie was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that it was like, when it was moving from one character to the next, that there was a lot of overlapping sound.
Yeah.
So it was like somebody would be playing violin or something about 10 seconds before you actually saw them. And that you'd be hearing someone's monologue about 3 or 4 seconds before you actually saw them. And it kind of created this atmosphere, a little bit like these kids are kind of all sort of competing for your attention in some respects. Yeah. And it also kind of played a little bit. We've been talking about Nashville before. It plays a little bit into the kind of Robert Altman effect too, of like kind of a lot of competing sound. The scene that ends up in the cafeteria that ends up becoming, you know, sort of like a big kind of dance number also very much feels a lot like a Robert Altman scene.
But maybe what's different though is that in a Robert Altman movie, all the sound would be pretty blurry, muddled.
Yes.
And I mean, I think that the sound really was quite clear for that cafeteria
scene.
Clear, but also just like a bunch of competing voices.
But that was part of what made that scene really pop out. Was, I mean, the way it's shot, but also that you can hear every instrumental part like very, very clearly.
When the music starts, then it does.
Yeah. Yes.
Before it kind of that happens, it really, and in some respects, it's, I would argue that that is also a great decision on in terms of sound editing, is that it kind of starts as this big cacophonous thing that slowly kind of starts to, you know, you start to hear the individual elements come through.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Well, this is nominated for Best Sound at the Oscars that year. It loses to The Empire Strikes Back. That's a tough one.
At least it got the nomination.
It won for score. It won for original song for Fame.
Right. Yep.
And it's not, other nominations were Out Here on My Own, also nominated for original song. Can't win two.
Yeah.
nominated for best sound, nominated for screenplay, nominated for editing.
Yeah, nice. It's pretty celebrated.
Particularly
yeah.
like the beginning audition scene, the editing, or I keep saying scene, the beginning audition section, all those scenes, very well edited because they are, it is so fast paced.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
that was
snappy.
That was another thing that in my mind justifies the Boogie Nights comparison is that the pacing as you go between all these different plot lines is still impeccable.
Yeah. I mean, on top of the sound design, I think this movie just looks great.
It does.
Like, it looks beautiful. It is a really professional outfit that did this. The cinematographer, Michael Saracen, is actually a frequent contributor of Alan Parker, and he did a lot of movies with him in the 80s. And I just want to mention one quick little thing, which is we mentioned earlier that Flashdance is a movie that I think is very influenced by Fame. And Flashdance's director is Adrian Lyne, who also directed the movie Foxes, that the same year that Fame came out, the Foxes cinematographer was also Michael Saracen.
Interesting.
Interesting little connection there. But go ahead, Julian.
So I guess, I mean, the funny thing that I still have to say is with that cafeteria scene, I had to think of the SNL sketch, What's Up With That, Just the way that like the sound appears out of the blue and everyone's suddenly going along with it.
Totally.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
But then the other like more serious point that I was thinking about as we draw this to a close was kind of about, I was interested to consider what's not shown in a movie like Fame. And I found it interesting. You don't really learn much about, like, are these characters going to college? What is there for them beyond high school? And I mean, I don't think it's an issue with the movie that they don't show that, but it's a selective narrative choice, of course.
I feel like Graduation kind of comes out of left field.
It does.
It kind of does.
Well, there's, like, there's the movie's over.
There's some truth to that. I mean, it's like graduations kind of just happen. Like, I've had graduations that feel like the only reason I feel the pomp and circumstance is because it's scheduled. Yeah. It's not like if you, like, otherwise my life would just go on. But yeah, you don't really find out what's going on with, like, with college applications. And at least, you know, maybe there's something about time period to this, but in this day and age, applying for college is such an abundant part of the high school experience.
Particularly, a lot of these kids are going to need to also audition at colleges if they're pursuing performing arts or like get a portfolio together. So, I mean, it's very stressful.
There's a moment early in the movie too when Doris's mom mentions to explain why she's trying to send her here is that they can't afford a professional children's school. And that was like another interesting point, partially because of some of my own scene experience, which is like, I mean, it's very tangential, but my high school, like on the walk to my high school from the subway, there was literally a school called Professional Children's School, just a few blocks off of Columbus Circle. Like, I believe like some prominent people like Scarlett Johansson went there.
Gotcha.
And it's like these performing arts schools exist for younger students too, like tuition-based performing arts schools. I mean, that's an interesting thing to consider too. Maybe some of these people going to the High School of Performing Arts in Fame aren't like thinking about going straight into their careers. Maybe it's financial for them.
That could be. Very much so. Did you have any other point that you wanted to make?
I feel like, Julian, maybe you were going to ask this question. I don't know that we have time to really dig too far into it, but the fact that this takes place over the span of 4 years. I mean, I think it's interesting. I don't know that it's done that effectively.
I mean, it's also tough because it's like when you see these auditioning, they look exactly the same.
I bought it though.
I didn't.
Yeah. I mean, and I understand it's very difficult to do that, especially for an age target like that.
Yeah.
You change so dramatically between like 14 and 18.
Yeah. I was thinking like, this is probably the best they could do because what are the alternatives? Either you do like a Boyhood where you just find these kids when they're 14 and just...
Fat chance that's happening.
Follow them for the next 4 years.
Yeah. It'll look a lot more like 28 Up or something if you
exactly.
did that.
Or you do like a High School Musical, like Harry Potter, like where you have to split into multiple movies, or like a television show.
Right.
So again, that you can like span a larger amount of time. Like, I think they probably did it as effectively as they could in this format.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's where you were alluding to. You kind of understand.
Yeah.
Based on the confines, you're like, yeah, you're going to have to suspend your disbelief a little bit in these auditions, you're looking at somebody who's probably 19 or 20.
But they just like, they show Doris and they've like tried to age her down by like giving her pigtails. I think it's a little silly because I'm like, this woman is 20.
But at least in the way the characters were written, I totally bought them growing
up.
And
the way that they're written, I totally buy it. Visually, I do not buy it.
Yeah, it was a little distracting for sure.
But yeah, then with this 4-year scope, I mean, it's the polar opposite of what we just considered with Dazed and Confused, where it's one tonight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And someday. But yeah. Like, yeah, I think what this movie, I kind of got to it earlier, what this movie really nails about that four-year experience in a New York City school is the sense of how your friend group thins over time, but you find greater focus with a few people who you really want to be friends with. And I guess, you know, the small price that approach pays in the movie is that there are some other people in the ensemble who you see less of as it goes along.
Absolutely.
And I mean, while it is accurate in the sense of the perspective of high school, in the sense that there are other people around who you like, you know, are there, but you don't really know what's going on with them. I mean, you know, I would have wanted to know what's happening with some of those other students who get a little less of a spotlight once you get into junior and senior year in the movie.
Sure. I think the movie is edited pretty well, though. Like, I think you get enough of who you want.
That's true.
Really, really want to see. I would agree with you that I think some plot lines are, they don't get quite the attention, and maybe as a result, they don't feel quite as satisfying.
Yeah.
It's like, looking back on Dazed and Confused, it's like, is there something that happens to a character in that movie? Like, is that movie, in a lot of ways, feels a little bit like it's kind of arc-less for a lot of the characters. It's more of a hangout movie. And it's like, maybe you could make the argument that the pink character sort of learns to lean into the fact that he's like, no, like, I don't have to sign this paper.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's kind of maybe the closest thing to like a full arc in the film.
Yeah.
And one thing that movie does, I think, capture somewhat nicely, if you want to look at it through that lens, is that sometimes a realization that can follow you for the rest of your life does really happen in one night.
Yeah.
And that this movie is a little bit more like trying to understand the way that 4 years feels a lot like it's having this really big impact on you. Mm-hmm. It's just, I guess both movies are, well, I don't know. Like, Dazed and Confused, I think, maybe like does not have ambitions to necessarily do that. Maybe that's me reading into that movie, trying to find something, but
I just want to say that this movie loses the editing Oscar to Raging Bull,
tough year, man. Tough year for Fame.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's one little detail that I wanted to mention.
I also just want to say, it does win original song. It beats 9 to 5.
Ah, okay.
By Dolly Parton.
Yeah. Yeah, which is another pretty iconic tune.
Well, speaking of like small spans of time, I mean, it's amazing how much reputation can be set in one night of the Oscars.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like these things that are so well known across time can meet each other. I mean, relatively little circumstances in ways that feel huge at that time. But, you know, when these things just become famous over the broader sweep of time, it hardly matters.
Yeah. And it's like, we are at the time that we're recording this, the Oscars are this coming weekend. Mm-hmm. And who knows, you know, in another 40 years, like what, you know, maybe this year would be a similar year.
I think it's totally possible. I think so too.
Yeah. Where this is kind of a historic year where you look back 40 years from now and you're like, wow, I can't believe all these movies converged.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I wanted to mention one more little detail that really touched me on a personal level. And you know, there's that one scene where Ralphie and Doris, it looks like they're rehearsing a scene, and they're like dancing with one another and they're talking to one another.
Yeah.
Do you guys know what that's from?
No.
No. No.
It's a movie that I talked about earlier when we talked about Oscar movies, a movie that I love, is a very deserving Oscar winner from 1955. Marty.
Oh,
it's right from that movie.
You know,
it is a great scene.
I did see in the credits that Marty was mentioned there.
Yes. Yeah. It is a fantastic scene. And I, even though I know that that's their moment where they're supposed to realize that they really get along, I, like Montgomery, was like, guys, there's a bunch of wonderful dialogue that comes right after this that you're not getting
to. Wait, you're cutting the scene short.
You're cutting the scene short. It is a fantastic scene. I implore upon you guys to see Marty. It is a beautiful film.
Duly noted.
Do we want to hit a little bit of unlikely shared universe? I got that mixed up when we were talking about unlikely shared universe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can start.
Go for it.
So we talked a little bit about Ralph's comedy career, which we see fairly short-lived, but maybe he, you know, gets some more success, doesn't necessarily bomb next time. But it seems like maybe the MC of this comedy show these aren't very well attended. Like, no. I don't know that his sets are doing that well either. And I think that perhaps he could use a pivot to a different career. Maybe yeah, detective maybe. Work. I think that before that, and this is canonical to what it will be connected to, he was an occasional reporter and music reviewer for the alternative magazine, The Paper. I mean, I didn't know this personally.
No, but you know what? That seems like a really nice stepping stone.
Yeah.
I think to what's coming up.
Exactly. But yeah. Seems like a nice stepping stone.
I'm seeing this. Yeah.
But I don't know that I'm going to thread it together perfectly. But I do think that eventually he is going to be able to move on from New York. Maybe he'll come back. But at first I think he's going to end up in Baltimore. And over there in Baltimore, I think he has finally found his calling, and he does become a detective to investigate homicide and life on the street.
Got it.
Homicide, life on the street.
Homicide, life on the street.
And this guy's name is John Munch.
This guy's name is John Munch. He also, I mean, this same character ends up moving back to New York for SVU.
Yes, that's actually how I knew him.
Maybe appears, he returns, you know, makes a brief stop in Baltimore for a moment. To appear amongst a bunch of cops who we know from The Wire.
Perhaps. Yes. But that's what I'm saying, though, is that Homicide, Life on the Street takes place in Baltimore, and these are the same character.
Right.
Yeah.
Right,
Homicide and SVU.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So we're
not like those are already, and it's not even unlikely.
That is
a
shared.
Canonical shared universe.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And we are sharing fame with it. These two universes.
I love it. It's all connected.
It's more than likely that is confirmed.
Yeah. Yeah. My parents really love Homicide. I've not watched a whole lot of it, and I've watched basically zero of SVU. So I was like, I don't know that I'm the perfect person to do this, but I'm going to give it a go.
No. I think it's great. I mean, my connection with this actor is
Richard
also,
Belzer.
Thank you. Yeah. Richard Belzer. Yeah. Is from SVU.
Yeah. It's, I mean, like, and my little connection, I mean, apart from knowing about him as a comic, is that, well, you know, there's one episode of The Wire where he makes a brief cameo as the series is wrapping up. And Homicide
Probably
Life on
the same character, I assume.
I assume so. And Homicide Life on the Street is also from the same creator, David Simon.
Right.
So I'm sure that's a more than intentional appearance of John Munch in The Wire.
I love it. That's great.
Yeah.
That's
so cool. I have to say about him in Fame, I just kept thinking the way he looked at that time, he was like the forgotten member of the Ramones.
Oh, definitely.
I thought the same. I literally was like, is Joey Ramone?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like actually in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't put it past them, you know, like New York based, like maybe trying to get like, you know, a cameo of some
kind. Maybe the Ramones were too busy promoting Rock and Roll High School when Fame was out.
Very possible. Yeah.
Because it was around the same time.
I got one more here too. Noticing, you know, Montgomery, you know, he kind of comes out into the world and, I don't know, just like this movie, just like we've seen kind of suggested in this movie, you know, really struggles to get into it with acting. You know, I mean, he tries it there in New York, doesn't really stick. And so he tries to make it in LA, maybe with some of his mom's acting connections. That also fails. And worse off, because it's his second stop that also doesn't work out. Things get pretty rough for him. He gets in with the wrong people just to make a fast buck. These legal troubles that start to mount force him to change his name to Emil, and he goes underground. He winds up in Detroit, where after several years of working up the food chain, he graduates to being a henchman for Clarence Boddicker, who is a connected and very powerful crime lord. And while holding up a gas station attendant at gunpoint for what seems like free gas for his motorcycle, a little questionable there, he's suddenly face-to-face with Detroit's latest officer of the law, a half-human, half-machine hybrid known as RoboCop. Yes.
Well, maybe RoboCop could use some help from John Munch.
Yeah, maybe so. Oh, my gosh. Guys, Detroit and Baltimore, I mean...
They're both cities.
They're both. Yes, they're both cities.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But
far apart.
That is Paul McCrane, by the way, who plays Montgomery, also happens to play Emil, who, he ultimately meets an insanely grisly fate in RoboCop.
Which I do not hope for Montgomery.
I know, I don't want that either.
It's unlikely, but still possible.
Yes. Yes. Unlikely, but possible. That's true.
And I'm not going to go all the way through this one, but I mentioned that Maureen Teefy appears in Grease 2. She's one of kind of the new pink ladies in Grease 2. I couldn't figure out how to connect these because it would mean she would have to go through high school twice.
Yeah, that's a pretty fitting thing to mention, though, considering what we're going to talk about next in this cycle.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Do you want to set it up for us?
Sure. I'm so excited. So this, we have been talking about high school movies for, like, talking about doing this series for a long time. And I think part of it was because you have a high school movie.
I do have a high school movie.
That you have a very deep connection with. And when we started talking about this, I was like, I also have this high school movie that I love dearly. So we're actually going to be doing two suggestion boxes this
Absolutely.
Cycle.
Excited for that.
We're going to start with mine, which is Grease. Grease is a movie I've mentioned a couple times on this very episode. It's a movie, probably the movie I've seen the most times in my life. And somehow a movie that you, Julian, have never seen.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I know surface level things about it, but yeah, I've never seen it.
Oh, man.
Maybe it's just kind of the same thing as with Fame. Like, I've known about it this whole time.
I can see that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
cool. I'm excited to talk about it too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll get into it when we talk about the movie, but I'm excited for Grease.
In 2 weeks' time, I'll have seen it.
Yes.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Guys, this is a lot of fun. I feel like we really made Fame happen here.
Yeah, absolutely.
We sung the body electric.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, awesome.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Sleepless Cinematic Pod, and you can email us at sleeplesscinematicpod@gmail.com. You can follow myself on Letterboxd at Patroness of Cats.
You can follow me too, just at my name, Julian_Barthold.
I think that's it.
Rock on. Good night, guys.
Good night.
Great. Take care.